Greetings to the brightest audience in the country, and welcome to Theology Thursday. I'm Nicole McBurney. Every weekday, we bring you the news of the day, the culture, and science from a Christian worldview, but today, join me and Pastor Bob Enyar as we explore the source of our Christian worldview, the Bible.
Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Who is like a wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the sternness of his face is changed. Verse 2. I say, keep the king's commandment for the sake of your oath to God. Do not be hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand for an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. So Solomon is sure that you should keep the king's commandment. He is the king after all. And he says, of this I'm sure, and do it for the sake of your oath to God. Obey the king. Okay, that's fine. As a general rule, unless the king is evil, then if he commands you to do something wrong, then disobey him. Verse 4, where the word of a king is, there is power. And who may say to him, what are you doing? He does have the ultimate authority in his kingdom, as this should be. Earlier, I talked about a system of checks and balances, where you have to have the highest authority in a government or in a corporation or in a family. And if the highest authority is corrupt, then you're in trouble. And there's no way to guarantee that. Do you say, okay, in a family, if the husband is sinful, then the wife is in charge? Well, then you're in trouble. Because whenever the wife doesn't like what the husband's doing, she'll say, I'm in charge now. And if you have a government and you have a president, you say, well, you need to make sure Congress keeps him honest. Well, that didn't work, did it, in the last 8 years? Because Congress was equally corrupt, or more so than the president. And the Supreme Court had 9 men, many of whom said repeatedly, we have the right to kill kids. They're corrupt. So you have a problem when you have a government by the majority because people are corrupt. Here, he says, the word of the king is power. And that's as it should be. There must be a highest authority in a land. Either it's going to be a man or a committee. And if the highest authority is a committee, the bigger the committee, the more likely it will be corrupt. So the best chance a government stands of being righteous is not to have a bureaucracy or a government by committee, but governmental authority bound up in a single individual. That's the best chance for a good government. Even with that form of government, if you have a monarchy, most of your kings will be evil. But some will be really good. When you get a really good king, the nation will be good because it'll have no choice because the king is good. But with our system of government, when is it going to get good? When Ronald Reagan dies? No, that's not going to happen. When George W. Bush dies? No. Gerald Ford? He's up here in Beaver Creek. No. When Clinton dies or George W. Bush? No, it's not going to turn righteous just because somebody died and a new guy came in. It's too big. You can't put new wine into old wineskins. You could put new wine into old senators from Massachusetts, but not in new wineskins. Verse 5. He who keeps his command will experience nothing harmful. And a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. Okay, so Solomon is definitely upbeat about obeying the king. And he's committing a slight exaggeration here, which is okay. You can exaggerate and that's acceptable, hyperbole. But if you keep the king's command, you'll experience nothing harmful. Even still, it's a bit of a stretch. And a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. That second part is completely true, always. I mean, to the extent a man has wisdom, he could discern the times, the season. What is the political climate? What is the chance that my wife is going to be angry if I tell her that I put the house up for sale? what a wise man can discern, time and judgment. So he's right. Verse 6, because for every matter there is a time and judgment, though the misery of man increases greatly. For every matter there is a time and a judgment, though the misery of man increases greatly. Now, there's a lot of misery in the world, right? But C.S. Lewis, he wrote a book called The Problem of Pain. And in that book, he argues, he said, pain is a problem, but let's not exaggerate it. And so is misery, but let's not exaggerate it. People say, how could there be a loving God when there's so much pain? There's a lot of pain in the world, but he argues effectively that you don't really get to add up pain. Each person experiences the pain in their life. And then that's what pain is. If a plane crashes and one person dies or 200 people die, each there are family members who are going to grieve, and there's a person who's going to be scared out of their wits as the plane is crashing, and then it's over. And either they're in heaven or hell. So the total amount of pain, I think, by people who want to argue against God is exaggerated. Pain is serious, but let's not over-exaggerate it. Like when liberals say, the poor always get poorer, and the rich always get richer. Well, they've been saying that forever. So by now, the poor would be invisible, and the rich would own everything. And they don't. So misery increases in our lives and in the life of a nation when we turn from God, but it tends to be cyclical. Verse 7, for he does not know what will happen, so who can tell him when it will occur? Now, what does Solomon mean here? A thread that he picks up through the rest of the book is about death. And you don't know when you're going to die, and whether you're good or evil, everybody's going to die. So what's the sense of it? And he laments the fact that we don't know when we're going to die. And we'll see that as we go on. And I would suggest that the only way to live life is not knowing what the future holds. Otherwise, how could you live life? You could maybe be something else, like a computer or a rock. But to be a human being with the freedom to make choices, you can't know how long you will live. And I don't think that's something to lament. Verse 8, no one has power over the spirit to retain the spirit, and no one has power in the day of death. There is no release from that war, and wickedness will not deliver those who are given to it. Now, these things are true, very good. Honest and true statement, and he makes a handful of them. All this I have seen and applied my heart to every work that is done under the sun. There is a time in which one man rules over another to his own hurt. Amen to that. When men try to lord it over one another, that's one of the most vile of human behaviors. Controlling, trying to lord it over your neighbor. And that's effectively what politics is, men trying to lord it or to rule over their neighbors. Then I saw the wicked buried, who had come and gone from the place of holiness, and they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This also is vanity. So the wicked who had come and gone from the place of holiness. Yeah, that happened. There's somebody who's righteous, and they turn away from their righteousness, and they commit iniquity, and God says, I will forget your righteousness. I will remember it no more. Ecclesiastes 3, for example. I'm sorry. Ezekiel 3, for example. If a righteous man turns from his righteousness and commits iniquity, then I will forget that he was ever a righteous man, and he will die in his sin. Now comes a very true statement of Solomon's. Verse 11. Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. So if you don't have a swift sentence, let's say you arrest a criminal, you try him, he's guilty, and you're going to punish him in 3 or 4 years or 10 years after he commits the crime, there will be no deterrent effect. If a child needs to be spanked, but you're going to spank him tomorrow because you can't quite get yourself to do it right away, well, then don't do it. Don't spank him tomorrow. The sentence needs to be executed speedily for it to have a deterrent effect. Now, I must confess, when I use this passage in a death penalty debate, I don't take the time to explain Solomon's impaired state of mind when he wrote it, because some of his statements are extremely negative. Others are nuggets of wisdom, and they're interspersed. And so someone, like, for example, Christians who believe in annihilation, that when you're dead, you're dead, you're in the grave, and you know nothing, and there's no love, there's no knowledge, there's no work, there's nothing. When you're dead, you're dead. Christians who believe that, they like Ecclesiastes, because there are verses that say that. So now, I don't believe in annihilationism. I believe that you're aware and alert and sentient throughout the rest of eternity. So when I come to those verses, I say that's Solomon's backslidden confusion. But when he says something I like, that I agree with, I say, well, there is a little bit of wisdom that's seeped in. Now, do you notice the danger in that? What's the danger? Somebody want to shout it out? That you, either side can do the same thing. So it is very dangerous in that you become the authority. You say these verses are false and these are true. And that's a danger. How can you do that? Well, if you know the story of the whole Bible and you apply it to the text honestly, then you could understand it. And if Solomon says, when a man dies, it's just like an animal, they're both dead, there's no knowledge or love in the grave, I say he's wrong, because the Bible tells us that we live forever. And in the grave, there is awareness of God and of ourselves and others. Verse 12, though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. Amen to that. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he does not fear before God. Yes. Amen. This is the man who wrote, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So he does know that. That's there in his mind. But when God said, do not multiply wives, and over a period of many years, he kept adding every week to his harem, he had turned his back on God. When God said, don't worship other gods, especially don't worship Molech, and he builds an altar to him. So he knows the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Yet he stopped fearing the Lord. Verse 14, there is a vanity which occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. Now, the word vanity or futile does not accurately describe this condition because of the coming judgment day. He's saying, look, some people are good and bad things happen to them. And there are other people that are bad and good things happen to them. Therefore, everything is futile. That's not true. That is the worldview of someone who doesn't believe in a righteous king. Because when evil people get wealth, that wealth is stored up for their judgment. And it's not going to go well with them at the end. If you are very short-sighted and you're only looking at the time that the Bible describes as a wisp of air or a flowering grass that fades away, in that short period of time, it looks like the wicked are better off. But in reality, they're not at all. At this point in Solomon's life, he is experiencing extreme pessimism. And he's brought gloom to a literary art form. Verse 15, "So I commended enjoyment, because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry. For this will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life, which God gives him under the sun." So, five times Solomon says this in this book of Ecclesiastes. There's nothing better that a man can do than eat, drink, and be merry. Now, is there any possible sense in which that's true? Any possible sense? No. There's no possible sense in which the best thing a man can do is eat, drink, and be merry. There's nothing better that you can do. You can't humble yourself before God. You can't serve your neighbor. You can't feed the hungry, because you have to be home partying. Of course, you could go out and feed the hungry, but there's nothing better to do than to eat, drink, and be merry. Now, if Solomon said that once in a proper context, okay, eat, drink, and be merry, I'm all for it. I'm in. You know, where's the party? Where's the picnic? I'll go. But as we see, as we continue, that's not it. This is Solomon's summer of discontent. Only it turns into fall and winter. He became critical of God and of life, and therefore exaggerates man's dilemma, and he gives bad counsel on how to live one's life. Now, nothing better than to eat, drink, and be merry. In the episode of the golden calf in Exodus, Moses wrote that the people were eating and drinking and playing. And then God destroyed. Remember 3,000 with the Levites? In Matthew 24, Jesus described the days before the flood when they were eating and drinking until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they didn't know until the flood came and took them all away. Jesus also spoke of the evil servant who eats and drinks with the drunkards. And that's not a phrase of a spiritual life or commitment or maturity or growth. It's not wrong to eat and drink and make merry unless you do so as an attempt to find meaning in life, to find the ultimate fulfillment, to find what's most important in life is just to have good friends and party. That's not true. If for you, eating, drinking, and being merry are out of priority, then you have a problem to solve. So five times in Ecclesiastes, in chapter 2, we saw this, Solomon said there's nothing better than to eat, drink, and enjoy. In chapter 3, he said there's nothing better than to eat, drink, and enjoy. In chapter 5, there's nothing better than to eat, drink, and enjoy. Here, he says in chapter 8, there's nothing better than to eat, drink, and be merry. In chapter 9, he says, eat and drink wine with a merry heart. Now, I don't want to beat a dead horse. Those things are okay unless it's your obsession and your goal to find fulfillment in life. Solomon is guilty of urging these otherwise healthy activities to an obsessive degree. Verse 16, "When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, even though one sees no sleep day or night," in other words, if you fully dedicate yourself to wisdom and understanding, to know how the world works, then, verse 17, "I saw all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun." I applied everything I have to wisdom, and I saw that a man cannot find out what is done under the sun. In other words, it's hopeless to find out why things are the way they are. "For though a man labors to discover it, yet he will not find it. Moreover, though a wise man attempts to know it, he will not be able to find it. Solomon is very skeptical here and negative, and I think it's uncalled for. Remember the wisdom God gave him? Two women claim the same baby, and he figures out who's the real mom and who's the kidnapper. And he didn't have any witnesses. He just had tremendous wisdom to see into an unknowable situation, because wisdom helps you to perceive the truth behind the facade. But here Solomon says, no matter how much wisdom you possess, no matter how much God blesses you with knowledge and understanding, you will never know anything that will help you. It sounds like bah humbug to me. Chapter 9. For I considered all this in my heart, so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. Now, what do you think of that? People do not know love nor hatred by anything they see. Is that all people? Or is that both the wise and the fools? Neither God's people nor his enemies can identify love nor hatred. We can't see love in the action of Boaz, nor hatred in that of Pharaoh. Of course we can. Can we see love in the Good Samaritan and hatred in Herod? We can. What is Solomon's implication when he says that we are in the hand of God? What a nice thing to say. We're in the hand of God. That's nice, right? He implies by his previous statement and the subsequent one that therefore we're in darkness. We can't see anything. Right? Let's use the next verse. Okay, let's just look at that again. The previous verse, no matter how hard we try, we can't find out anything. And the next thing he says in chapter 9, verse 1, we can't know love nor hatred by anything we see before them, because we're in the hand of God and he keeps us in darkness. It's all a mystery. We can't know. You see how it depends on how you go to the book. If you go to the book and think Solomon is repentant and righteous and writing as a godly scribe, then you focus on we're in the hand of God. In the confusion that comes before it and afterward, you gloss over. If you think, on the other hand, that Solomon is fully backslidden, then you take the little gems of wisdom as leftovers, and you see the confusion as his main theme. And during the break, Jason asked, well, why is this book in the Bible? Why would it be in the canon? And Carl answered that this was inspired stupidity. That if someone wanted to know what was wrong, you look in the book of Ecclesiastes and you'll find what is wrong. Now, I'd like to use the next verse to compare the two styles of interpretation of Ecclesiastes. The one I've been using, we could call the backslidden Solomon's confusion method, and the more common one, that Solomon was spiritually alive and repentant. This here commentary, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, it's very popular, published by Zondervan, very good. And they say that Solomon was evil, but he repented, and he wrote Ecclesiastes after he repented. That's what they say. And I ask, well, where do they get that he repented? Where is that in the story? Because it's not in the account of Solomon's life. So they said that Psalm 89 proves that Solomon repented. So I thought that was fascinating, because I didn't think, I thought, okay, let's see. So Psalm 89, it says no such thing, but it does say that God established a covenant with David. And then it says that if David's sons forsake God's law, God will punish them. It says that. And then it says that nevertheless, God will be faithful to David. It says that. It doesn't say that Solomon repented. It said if David's sons are evil, God will punish them. That's all it says about his sons. That's it. And then when it says, but God will be remain faithful to David, they say, oh, see, Solomon must have repented because God would be faithful to David. Huh? Where did they get that from? Obviously, they haven't read the chapter on that God will not punish a child for his father's sins or bless a child for his father's righteousness. So verse 2, let's look at it and see how you could take it. You know, you could try to take it either way. All things come alike to all. One event happens to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good, the clean, and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath, as he who fears an oath. Now, is this brilliant, inspired truth, or is it corruption from a debased mind? Which is it? Are all things come alike to all? Well, not salvation, not forgiveness, not righteousness, not mercy. And, you know, some things happen to everybody. It rains on the just and the unjust, and we all die, except for Enoch and Elijah and in the last generation. But as is the good, so is the sinner. And he who takes an oath, as he who fears an oath. Now, since Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say Solomon repented, and this is all inspired truth, they have to make sense out of every verse. And every time when Solomon says, the best thing is to eat, drink, and be merry, they have to find a way of affirming that, which effectively is to deny it. They say, of course, the best things are to love God and love your neighbor and do all this. And if you do all the best things, then it's okay to eat, drink, and be merry. But that's not what Solomon said. He's saying everything else is useless, so the best thing you could do is eat, drink, and party. But what they say here is they say this, to deal with this one verse, and we could go through the whole book like this, but they say all things refers to death. Let's say all things comes to all, and this whole section of the next 8 verses refers to death, pretty much, especially this verse. Well, not really. All things, that's plural, come to alike to all, and as is the good, so is the sinner, and he who takes an oath as he who fears an oath, that doesn't have anything to do with death. He's saying no matter how you live your life, you're all going to end up in the grave. So I say, no, Solomon's not referring just to death, but he's referring to life in general, and whether a man is good or evil, the good man is as the sinner, and he who takes an oath is as he who does not. Verse 3, this is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that, they go to the dead. And that's a rather discouraging perspective on life. All right? This is an evil that one thing happens to all.
Hey, this is Nicole McBurney jumping into the broadcast. We are out of time for today, so be sure to come back next Thursday to hear the rest of this study. To find other resources and Bible studies, be sure to go to kgov.com/store. That's kgov.com/store.